Hello, you're listening to the Sound Approach podcast channel. Interviews and conversations with a focus on birds and conservation issues. If you're a birder, and in the last 30 years or so anyway, have been to Portland Bird Observatory, one of 19 bird observatories developed around the UK, the chances are high that you will have met its likeable and easygoing warden, Martin Cade. Martin has become synonymous with the OBS over the years. He's a walking encyclopedia on its birds and its moths, a permanent fixture chatting or rolling cigarettes on the famous patio with its views over the OBS garden and away in the distance the English Channel, or strolling cheerfully around the nets, checking to see what the winds might have dropped in. My name's Charlie Moores, and in the 1990s and early 2000s, I used to visit Portland more or less every week. As much for the conversation and the good-natured banter as for the birds, the unique plants, the invertebrates. And then as personal circumstances abruptly changed, I stopped going. I realised recently that it had been almost a decade since I'd last driven down through Dorset to Weymouth, across Ferry Bridge and up the Long Hill to the top of Portland itself. To be honest, I wondered what sort of reception I might get when I phoned to ask Martin if he'd do an interview with me. I needn't have worried. Of course, he said, it'd be good to see you, like I'd never been away. And I really can't quite explain how grateful to be still included made me feel. So Martin, thank you very much. I really appreciate the time. Pheasant calling out there. I don't remember pheasants being a sound of Portland. I was just thinking as I drove down here, there were certain sounds that I really keyed into when I was used to coming down to Portland,
right,
sort of 10 years ago now, I guess.
Yeah.
And it was obviously the sea, skylarks.
Yeah, pheasants a newcomer. Pheasants are sort of an odd one. You kind of think of inland, everybody just lets pheasants go to shoot them. You know, it's a really peculiar thing of Britain. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
We can't really understand it, but
we can have a long conversation
Portland,
about that.
Portland, bizarrely, nobody shoots things. They did used to years ago. They shot pigeons and trap sort of bunnies and whatever, basically just for the pot. But there's never been a tradition of shooting pheasants on Portland, and rather mysteriously, a few years ago, somebody took it upon themselves to release pheasants. But why would you do that? apart from the fact they look beautiful.
They are beautiful
birds. They're great birds. But, you know, from the point of view, you just think of them being birds that are released to be shot. But we don't know who did it. It was the sort of oddest thing. Pheasants are not going to migrate across the mainland.
No, of course not.
Yeah, clearly they've been dumped by someone. But we don't know who. And they have found a little niche that, they've gone mad. They breed all over the place, you know. So, after the breeding season, there's little, packs, coveys of youngsters wandering about all over the place. People are down sea watching at the tip of the bill, and suddenly, a little moving party of pheasants appear down by the obelisk. Like, what's going on? I think they're getting so prolific now that they're becoming quite ubiquitous out here. So, yeah, pheasant has become a sound of Portland. It's odd, really. Since your day, the sounds of Portland just sort of imperceptibly change. We were just talking before you started recording.
This is what I wanted to bring this in.
Everybody from the past, from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, the garden sound, the soundscape of South Portland was greenfinch.
Absolutely.
There would be greenfinches song flighting sort of out of the euonymus hedges around our garden.
Yeah.
And it was lovely. And you absolutely took them for granted. It was just such a constant feature. And they've gone.
That's
amazing, isn't it? Awful.
I was saying to you, I just figured that down here they'd have been sort of protected from the disease that's killed them.
Yeah, that's right.
Gardens all over
trichomoniasis. I mean, it's had the most profound effect on their population at an enormous level. I mean, not only has it done for our resident ones, which have gone, they haven't bred in the garden here for several years. It's clearly ever such a widespread thing, because we are not getting migrants either. We used to get lots of migrants.
The
guys ringing here would be catching a spring passage of them in addition to our garden birds. And particularly in the autumn, they'd be catching a really big southbound autumn movement. And we had ringing recoveries of ones which had been sort of first ringed in northern England, say. I think we've actually got one or two from further Norway and such places.
And that stopped.
That
was
a real feature. I think the last 2 years we haven't even got into double figures of ringed greenfinches at Portland Bird Observatory, and they're a thing. It would not be unusual to ring 500 in a year in the past, and it's got down to single figures. And
it's a real collapse.
It clearly involves an enormously wide geographical area. It's not just us. The whole source area of the migrants we got, it's affected all of that. I mean, that is really worrying. And you know, I know we spend a lot of time slating farming practices and things like that. This is not a farming practices issue. This is just a really nasty biological event that's sprung up almost out of the blue. And, you know, it's absolutely kind of gripped right onto poor old greenfinches and done for them over an enormous area.
I don't think many people are aware that.
No, it's a kind of below the radar event, I fancy. I mean, frankly, what can anybody do about it? I don't really know. I'm not sure there is anything you can do about it, apart from keeping your fingers crossed and thinking, God, I hope some of them get through this.
The survivors will be able to resist
the
disease.
There will be ones who become resistant, and then maybe the disease will kind of fizzle out. But at the moment, it's really worrying for them.
You know, this is going to bring in several questions that I had.
Yeah.
One of them, which we will touch upon, is what's the purpose of a bird observatory in 2018? And that might well be one of the things that it's still key for, being able to spot these trends. But what I wanted to begin with was saying, ironically, very little has changed down at Portland. Apart from greenfinches, there is a kind of a natural rhythm down
here. That's what I really, really like about it. There is a fantastic continuity at Portland, which really does stretch right back to the pioneering days. I mean, the pioneering days here were in the immediately after the war. People started to get gripped by the sort of phenomena of bird migration and finding particularly coastal headlands where you could tap into bird migration. Pre-war, you know, pioneers Lockley on Skokholm and Eagle Clark on Fair Isle, they were aware of this, but it was not a thing which had really sort of gripped the wider birding community. But suddenly, particularly in the 50s, it was a thing that really gripped the birding community, that they were able to go out onto coastal headlands. And the early pioneers here, they first started arriving in the early 50s, sort of 51 sort of onwards. There was a fellow called Dr. Rook. You know, they were largely fairly well-to-do folk who had enough income to indulge in their passions. It was not the sort of thing
that's
that the ordinary
the big
working
change
man
in the
would
70s
have done.
And 80s,
yeah, very
it,
much when, so. Now, yeah. Now it's the sort of thing that kind of anybody can get into. But then in those days, it was the rather well-to-do who were the pioneers here. And
you had to have spare time available
to
do it
as
well.
And they, you know, they had no base in that era. They would drive down at weekends. They would, I think, you know, they started off things camping, and then they had one or two temporary sort of premises. They did deals with sort of local people and had little places they could stay for periods. Bizarrely here, they even stayed underground for a while, which you would not imagine.
No.
They found an old, I think it predated the war, but it was used in the war as an ammunition store further up the island, a kind of rather cave-like affair. And after the war, it had obviously become redundant, and they were given permission to use this. And so there are still, even now, one or two folk who can remember as keen teenagers actually coming and staying in these sort of this underground kind of bunker affair.
A really damn
up at Southwell. Ah, oh, godforsaken place, you would imagine. But such was the enthusiasm of youth and whatever, that they put up with these privations for the privilege of being out on Portland Bill looking at, you know, in those days, it was really exciting times. You know, there had hardly, I forget how many Melodious Warbler records there were for Britain at that time, but it was, I think it was almost single figures ever in the UK. And the guys here came here and suddenly started seeing Melodious Warblers every autumn. You know, this was a kind of really exciting time. And they were tapping into some great stuff.
It's almost a shame, isn't it, that the more they look, the more they realise that actually melodious warblers are fairly regular migrant. Yeah. You can expect it. Yeah. Those highs are just, they aren't going to come back.
No. That was an era of such exploration and discovery.
Yeah.
You know, you have to remember that the quality of the optics, we were saying it had improved, but it was nothing like these days.
No, these days,
everybody can just sit on our patio and sea watch with these 2,500 pound telescopes. You know, in those days it was lucky if you had a telescope, and if you did, it was a draw tube thing
that you had
to sort of prostrate yourself on the floor and rest it on your knees. And so you had to go and right down to the tip of the bill to see what.
How far is the sea from the patio?
From the patio, it must be kind of half a mile, I suppose, to the end of the bill. You know, you can sort of do everything from here these days, but you couldn't in those days. And you know, they would go out with their inadequate optics, and the quality of the literature was awful relative to now. Yeah, yeah. It was a real era of such discovery, and it must have been really exciting. You know, I come a little bit later when there was still exciting times back in the mid-70s when I was a teenager, but 20 years before that, oh, that must have been such an exciting time.
Would you have preferred then to have been around when the optics weren't good and there were no field guides?
I think overall, I would have quite liked to have experienced those early days.
Okay.
That sounds like an era that everything was new. And I'm a little bit sad to have missed that. But I think, as we touched on before, there is a lovely continuity here, in as much as I still have people visiting here who remember that era, who were participants in that. I think it almost makes us unique in the British Bird Observatory sort of movement to have those pioneers who are still about now and can tell me what it was like in the 50s, and the stories are fantastic. But there is a lovely continuity to it.
I mean, I came down for the first time for must be 10 years.
Yeah.
And four of the people sat talking to you were the same people who were down here 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean,
it's like
I have got
friends. It's amazing.
I've got helping out with the bird ringing here at the moment. Peter Morgan, who is the current chairman of PBO. You know, we're a little registered charity, so we have a lot of trustees.
Yeah.
Peter's our chairman. Peter was actually the first paid warden of the new bird observatory in 1961.
61.
As a 19-year-old lad. you know, he lasted, you know, just over a year before he moved on to other things. He identified straight away with Portland as this place that from his youth, and he's still coming back now. You know, he's here now helping me out in 2018, and he can remember 1961.
I mean, you've been warden since 95.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a long time. I started off as assistant warden in 1989. Under Mick Rogers. Mick was a well-known character in British birding.
He had a very different style.
Very different style to mine. You know, he was not everybody's cup of tea, but we got on well, and I lasted quite a few years with him.
Yeah, I remember.
I was the only person who'd actually managed to last more than a year with Mick. And when Mick decided to jack it in, I took over from him in 95, and here I am still 23 years later. But we've been like that. Mick was here from 78, I think. So he'd had a really good long run. But there was a relatively brief Ian Robertson who came from Fair Isle and went back to Fair Isle. You know, maybe you wouldn't turn up your nose at an opportunity to be warden of Fair Isle if it came up.
And, no, I guess not.
And fair enough, you know, Ian didn't. You know, that was an exciting thing for him, having worked there previously. So he was a little bit short. But before that, it was Frank Clafton.
I mean,
back in the 70s, Frank and Beryl Clafton. I mean, everybody knew Frank and Beryl. I still have got Beryl here now. Poor old Frank died quite a few years ago, but Beryl still lives up the island. She still comes out, and, you know, I've still got photographs in our archive of Beryl with a little egret under her arm and sort of things like that. And she still comes out now, and she walks her dog round, and she's nearly always got a pair of bins with her, and she'll come in and tell me she's seen such and such and so and so. So Frank and Beryl were here right back to the era just after we mentioned Peter, back in the early 60s. So there actually have been very few wardens here altogether, which is great for the continuity, the recording point of view.
There's two different continuities, isn't there? There's continuity of the style of the observatory, and there's continuity of the information that's being collected.
The style of the place, we all got that from our philanthropic benefactor, that one of the early pioneers, if we go back to the sort of history of the OBS,
one
of the early pioneers was a sort of a lady, which was actually quite unusual in that era, because this was very much a male thing in that era, Helen Brotherton, who, you know, later became a real stalwart of sort of Dorset conservation and also, I think, a wider British conservation movement. But we were fortunate that she was a sort of lady of some means through her parents. She was one of the pioneers here. And they, during this time, they were pondering as to sort of what they should have as their base. And the old Lower Lighthouse here suddenly came on the market in the late 50s. And Helen, being a lady of some means, was able to twist her dad's arm to sort of buy the derelict lighthouse as the base for the bird watchers. Helen really wanted this to be a place where people who had not been as fortunate as her were able to come. So it was very much budget accommodation. It was good accommodation.
Yeah.
I mean, in the old, the famous John Gooder's
Where to Cave.
Well, of course, compared to what they'd had, it was great. But in British terms, I think the famous John Gooder's Where to Watch Birds in Britain book from back in the 70s described Portland as the Hilton of bird observatories. Helen kitted it out. It was a lovely, lovely venue, you know, but it was budget priced. Her whole idea was to sort of provide something with people who'd been, you know, less fortunate financially than her could sort of pitch up an experienced bird migration.
Provided you could get down here.
Great, you know, I mean, you can see by the size of our car park, I have perennial car parking problems these days. In that era, you know, only one person in 10 had a car, and those that did come down tended to sort of squeeze in five to the car.
That's right.
So we actually, our car park had very little use in those days.
Is that it's 9 or 10 car parking spaces?
It's way too small for this era, where sort of everybody's got three cars and most of them seem to want to bring two with them every time. I spend my time as a sort of car park attendant at sort of busy weekends. But and Helen sort of provided that. But I say the whole ethos of it was I mean, from the point of view of day visitors, it was all free. There were, you know, there was no charge for visiting. It was an open all hours. You know, you're welcome to pitch up whenever you want. And all the successive wardens have perpetuated that. And very much so. The whole ethos of the organisation. Well, you know, we've had the odd little moment. But it's still very much the same.
Much as I admire, you know, Mick as a bird, him and day visitors were not necessarily going to get along.
A personality thing. But it is the sort of place where you can pitch up. There isn't a charge for coming in. You know, it's lovely and old fashioned in that respect. I could run it as a business and charge everybody sort of £2 for coming in. But apart from that, that's an anathema to me personally. That was not Helen's ethos.
Right.
And I, you know, Helen's been, she passed away eventually. She got into her 90s, but she passed away 10 years ago or so now. But I mean, there's very much a wanting to carry on Helen's, you know, Helen's legacy was very much for keeping it running as it was in her era.
Were those instructions that she gave you're the right guy to run it from the thing.
It was an unwritten thing. Were it not for her, I strongly suspect that Portland Bird Observatory would not have survived. Sadly, from our point of view, we're in a very beautiful old Grade 2 listed building lighthouse.
Yeah.
The upkeep of that is extremely expensive. Throughout Helen's lifetime, she basically, out of her own pocket, forked out for all the repairs to the bird observatory. It's a pretty godforsaken environment here. You know, it's very windswept.
It's very nice in the summer, but it can,
you know,
be
we could perform our sort of valuable social function sort of birdwatching wise from porter cabins, which would not be quite as romantic as in a lovely old, you know, lighthouse.
Yeah.
But the lighthouse does come with, you know, comes with these great expenses.
Yeah.
You know, now we do have to fend for ourselves. But fortunately, you know, in the sort of modern era, you know, we are a little bit better off than we used to in Helen's time. And, you know, I think we survived. That's the main thing. Were it not for Helen, I'm quite sure we would not still be here. And so I very much like to perpetuate her outlook on,
right.
You know, her world view was very much like that.
She was she had amazing bearing, didn't she?
Very
dignified.
Oh, that's
you didn't
right.
mess her about.
No, you didn't. No, she could be a rather daunting sort of personality. Yeah. but behind that, I'd say she did a tremendous amount for us.
When you look forward, is the bits here that you love protected, do you think? Or
well, what you see, like what this? We found we've had to do, which we never, this was not envisaged in the early days of the OBS, is we have had to kind of digress into a lot of other facets of the sort of natural environment of Portland, really. You know, in the early days, it was very much looking at bird migration, having a little base, and, you know, and we had our daily rhythms of, you know, you send someone out sea watching, send someone out vis mig watching, and that was it. But we have had to sort of really move an awful lot because the environment of Portland has changed so much. You know, but basically in those early days, they had a lovely headland that was full of a whole variety of habitat. There was really interesting agriculture on South Portland. That has changed profoundly in not only the OBS's time, but even in my time. So something like the corn bunting, which was one of the most familiar birds of my childhood of coming to Portland, has just completely gone. Due to agricultural change.
Yeah.
And so the OBS in the last sort of kind of, I guess it's 15 years or so, we have become very, very much more involved with doing something about the sort of changing natural environment of this part of South Portland, the agricultural sort of less developed sort of end of Portland, to the extent that, you know, I think when Helen was alive, I'm not sure we twisted her arm isn't sort of fair, but we sort of got Helen on board with actually buying some tracts of land on South Portland and managing it from a wildlife conservation point of view. Mm. And since her death, that has continued. And I mean, we now, I call it farming, but you know, there is more to it than farming. We sort of farm 33 acres now of sort of South Portland here. And yeah, we have come by that in various ways. Some of it we still rent, one or two bits of it. Helen bought us a patch of fields up in what we call the top fields, and then due to a ever such generous bequest by a sort of regular bird watcher who used to come down here, we had another large tranche of money which we were able to put towards buying the fields just across the road from the bird observatory. It was Crown Estate land, which had been all sorts in my, I can remember it as sort of crop fields that had aquatic warblers in. I vividly remember an aquatic warbler in it back in the 1970s I was a nipper. And sadly, as agricultural practices changed on South Portland, so by and large, the crops disappeared.
Yeah.
So variety disappeared and almost everything became pasture fields.
It's hard to farm here, isn't it? Because it's very stony ground.
It's not the easiest place to farm. The soil is thin. It's a very exposed environment. But people did farm it. And we were lucky in the early days of the OBS in as much as it didn't have to be farmed in an economical manner, because a lot of it was farmed by, there's a prison and a borstal, a young offenders institution on Portland. And as part of the sort of rehabilitation of the guys there, they actually farmed really big tracts of Portland. So I remember when I was a kid, you know, you'd see borstal boys, prisoners out with their warders, and they had brilliant variety of fields. They grew potato fields, they grew cabbage fields, which were ace for birds. And because it was not being done in a really economical manner, it was mostly done for feeding the prisoners and the borstal boys, they didn't mind. The bird observatories, you had access to those fields and you could creep through potato fields and flush up grasshopper warblers. And that was exciting habitat to have on the headland. But that was all lost as that sort of changed. And so we have had to take the view that, well, the only way we're going to do anything about this is to do it ourselves. Nobody else is going to do it. And so we've had to buy the land. We've been very fortunate that one of our trustees, Richard Newton by name, had came with all the sort of necessary skills to sort of assist us in this. And sort of we leave it pretty much to him, sort of to sort of farm it in a suitable sort of bird friendly. It's not only bird friendly, you know, it is sort of other wildlife friendly manner. But we've now got 33 acres of South Portland sort of under sort of our sort of management regime, and yeah, that's worked well.
The land isn't used to produce food.
No. This is we grow sacrificial crops. You know, there is nothing in it for us. It costs us an awful lot of money to do it. Although last year we have actually rather fookily got into one of these stewardship agreements, which I never imagined we'd do. This era of Brexit and whatever. I thought, well, they're never going to give away money to a organization like us, but we've got in on a 5-year stewardship agreement for the management of part of our holdings, which is great from our point of view, because it means that, you know, it's just that little bit more that we don't have to spend our own money in managing everything. So it's great, you know, we've now got swathes of suitable fields, which are, you know, they're absolutely full of things like linnets in the autumn, you know. We grow things like maize for migrating sedge warblers in the autumn. So,
right,
you know, we have our kind of really, South Portland's bone dry by and large. It hasn't got reed beds and water or anything like that. So, you know, we planted maize fields, which is our sort of pseudo reed beds. Can't you be amazed how they have a tremendous passage of sedge warblers going through them? You have things like yellow wagtails roosting in the maize fields.
Really?
They see it basically just as the equivalent of a reed bed.
Yeah.
So brilliant stuff like that, which is, that's just habitat being used by birds. Whereas the sort of seed bearing sort of crops, you know, they're for the finches and whatever, they have.
And the little buntings.
I mean, they've been great for rarities. I mean, clearly that isn't the point of them.
Clearly.
But they've
not
been magnificent fields. Things like little bunting have suddenly become, you know, really tolerably regular sort of wise passage migrants here since we've got suitable fields.
How did you first come up here? You're from around here, but not Portland
itself.
Yes,
no, I'm not a native Portlander. I was actually born in Cornwall, but that's irrelevant to my birding heritage, if you know what I mean. I did actually live in this area, and for a few years I worked for the RSPB after sort of college at Lobmore and Radipole.
I think that's where I first got to know about you was there's this gull guy. Yeah,
this
down
is a
at
gull
Radipole.
Man. Gulls have moved on. In those days I was the gull guru.
You really were.
Sadly, gulls have moved on since my time. I think the Caspian gull hadn't even evolved. I'm sure it had, but we just couldn't recognise it. In those days, gulls were sort of things like med gulls and ringbilled gulls.
Ringbilled gulls. I always remember you looking for ringbilled gulls.
Frankly, they are basically a doddle, and you know, I learnt those things fantastically, you know.
And you learnt the call of med gull long before people
switched into med gulls overhead, yeah. You know, and I was really good at all that sort of stuff, even, you know, if I don't mind saying so myself.
I was good
at that selection of gulls that you've got a lot more Radipole. I mean, gulls now have moved on to basically everybody's into sort of big white headed gulls. And I mean, it's kind of freaky to think that in my era, like we say, Caspian gull hadn't evolved.
Nobody
had even heard of Caspian gull. No. I mean, I can remember when yellow-legged gulls started coming on the scene. Blimey, what is this bird? You know, and it was kind of hard to learn. It seems bizarre now. This,
you know, the bird everyone's looking for now with Vega gulls and slaty-backed gulls.
Things like that. Things that you never imagined.
No.
In those days, Weymouth had a lovely working, filthy old rubbish tip. Good old-fashioned rubbish tip. And so I would be there looking at, you know, from Lobmore, you know, I was supposed to be working, but I'd spend most of the, we digress slightly, but we'll go back to that in a minute. I was supposed to be working, but I spent an awful lot of time just gawping at gulls. Now I think back and think, God, I wish I'd learnt a bit more about big gulls. I mean, I could have almost made a name for myself with big gulls. Lobmore just had countless hundreds of gulls that would come off the rubbish tip to bathe there, lined up in front of me. And, you know, we were struggling trying to find a yellow-legged gull because we'd only just begun to realise what they were.
Do you know, I think the big difference, though, is everyone can take a picture now and take it home and look at it. Well, you guys were having to do it from little old pamphlets and articles in British Birds.
That's right. We had BB articles by, you know, Rob Hume was
Peter
our hero.
Grant
you know,
people.
Peter Grant was the sort of the big hero. But Rob Hume finding ringbill gulls on Blackpool Beach. And, you know, I can remember when the pioneer guys, you know, the Dick Philbys, the Steve Gantlett, who used to live in Weymouth, you know, Dave Fisher, you know, we were all talking about ringbill gulls being found. And in my sort of 10 years of gulling, you know, they became a routine bird for me. I sort of did crack them really well. And that's how most people knew me, I think, in that era.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I was the sort of Weymouth gull guy. And
you still, were always there, Martin.
I still get
never,
folk. Yeah, I know.
You never seem to take a day off.
No, I don't now. You know, I just so enjoy it. You'd think, are you not a bit more ambitious? But no,
well, now you're leaping to... That's a point I'm going to bring up right at the end.
Yeah, okay.
Because I have a view about what your ambition, and I think you've just cracked it perfectly. And I'll come back to that.
Yeah, sure.
But, funnily enough, there was a quote I wanted to read you really quickly, actually. It was from... I found it on the net from BBC Inside Out from June 16th, 2003.
Okay.
Where it says... Warden Martin Cade reckons he has one of the best jobs in the world. It's just such a buzz and it's different every day, explains Martin. You never know whether there's going to be a good fall of migrants or a good sea watch, or there could be swallows streaming through to be counted. And I've written underneath it, do you still feel like that?
Clearly, it's exactly the
actually
same.
Actually, you do.
It's
you haven't
exactly
changed an
same.
Iota since I've
no,
known you.
No, not at all. You know, and it is, every day is different. You have no idea what's going to happen every day. I mean, today, the day you're here, we actually thought it was going to be a good sea watch today. There was a good sea watch yesterday and, you know, folk were geared up. People were arriving early, you know, and it's been an absolute damp squib. But that's the way it is, you know, and a lot of days it happens the other way. You know, you wake up with no great sort of feeling for the day and it turns into something completely amazing. And I just love that. I just still get such a buzz from it.
Do you still get the buzz from common birds coming through?
Oh,
or
yeah,
is it
yeah,
thinking
yeah.
there might be
no,
a rarity?
No. You know, common scoters. Yesterday, I went down the bill and did a proper sea watch because the scoter were moving. I mean, I've seen it umpteen times.
Millions
of
scoters
have you seen? I've seen it umpteen times before. But do you know, I get so excited by it.
Do you know, I remember years ago, I did a VHS video of the birds of Portland.
Yeah, yeah.
And on it was some common scoter. And it was seasonal. And I will never forget, I'd reversed a bit of film. It looked slightly better from the angle that I'd shot it. We played it through and you went, you've swapped that film round because they don't go in that direction this time of the year.
Oh, brilliant.
I was so crestfallen. How the hell did he spot that? I should have realised. That was back in the end of the 80s at some point, wasn't it?
So, no, we moved on a bit there. I mean, how did I end up at Portland, I think, was where
we
were.
Yes,
I mean, I was working for the RSPB at Longmore Radipole. Yeah, I mean, the RSPB do great, great work. I mean, they're a magnificent organisation. But when I was with them, it was the era when they were beginning to become a really big organisation. You know, they had gone from being a place where their reserves were the sort of private fiefdom of certain, you know, the Bert Axels and the John Wilsons and Radipole had Doug Ireland, who was, you know, it was almost his private fiefdom, and he was really kind of not, you know, we got on well. You know, again, he was a bit like Mick. He was not necessarily the sort of person everybody got on with, but I got on with him well and we had a lovely time. And
just before you go on, Martin, I feel I've been a bit mean about Mick. I mean, the fact was he was a serious birder. To him, casual birding was a bit of a distraction.
Yes.
And that was really where it lay, wasn't it? Yeah. It was a really nice guy.
Mick was a lovely guy. Mick was a
especially in the evening
guy.
When the birds had gone and he could relax.
Oh, socially, he was a great guy to go out with.
He
was really good fun.
Yeah, I feel I've been a bit mean about Mick. I wouldn't want anyone to think that he's kind of been held up as this demon figure.
No,
he was a great guy. He's just had a different outlook to you. So you're talking about...
Yeah, and Doug at Radipole, you know, we had a lovely time, but, you know, it started to become a much more of a big money organisation. So suddenly there was all these sort of money and membership targets coming in. And, well, you see, I was a birder. And, you know, I appreciate this. All this stuff had to be done. But I wanted to spend all my time bumbling about birding. Which was great, you know. Doug managed to sort of fiddle it most of the time that I did. So I was doing all these nice things like breeding birds surveys and looking at gulls. And I, you know, I probably, you know, from a PR point of view, I probably did a lot of good work pointing out ring-billed gulls
to
people.
If you were a birder,
things like
you were
that.
The man to go
but,
to. Yeah.
But basically, I kind of felt I probably wasn't really doing enough birding. And... because I was in the area, a lot of my spare time was spent at Portland. Whatever way you look at it, in Dorset, Portland is the place you've got to be if you're interested in big falls of birds, good sea watches, rarities. you know, there are loads of lovely places in Dorset, but ultimately Portland Bill is the location. If you stick at it, it always gets more than anywhere else. And that was not lost on me. I thought, God, I've got to spend a lot of time out there. You know, I was finding...
How old are you at this point?
This is now... I had finished at college, so I was then into my mid-20s. And so from being very sort of set on Lodmore and Radipole, I suddenly found I was spending a lot more time at Portland. As I'm not a lister at all or anything like that. I've never actually been a big sort of lister as such. But I love the spectacle of kind of bird migration and, you know, the rarities that turn up in, you know, sort of headlands like this. I get really, really gripped by that, as I did then and still do now. So I was spending more and more time at Portland anyway. And yeah, the opportunity came up, really. There'd been some nice, you know, been some lovely guys who'd been Mick's assistants in the previous few years. Dave Walker, who's now at Dungeness.
Sean McMinn,
you know, lots of really nice guys, great birders, you know. And this particular year, I think it was 89, I was out sort of chatting to Mick, and it transpired that he hadn't got an assistant for that year. And I guess I was just sort of weighing things up and thought, you know, it was a big pay cut. But it was then I'd be actually sort of installed in this place that I was having to spend such a long time. And basically, I arrived in March 89 and I've never left.
So we're in April 2018.
It's a long time, 29 years.
That's a big year next year.
Yeah, next year will be my 30th year of sort of employment at PBO.
We should have done this next year.
Long time. There are several of the other Hobbs Wardens. Dave Walker at Dungeness, he's been there sort of almost as long. And, you know, there are several of them that have done long spells, but it is very much the exception. And a lot of the guys, sadly, the guys particularly on the islands, you know, that you can't really do, you know, they get married, they have a family and schooling and sort of issues like that become important to them. Whereas Portland being, I think of it as an island, but clearly it isn't. You know, we have got all facilities we want within easy reach. So there's schools for my children, there's supermarkets just up the road. It is the sort of place where you can do a long, long stint.
But it has got that remarkable feel of feeling still like it's not quite connected.
It has all that island feel about it. For me, absolutely, it's got, you know, I've been to the sort of the Fair Isles and the other sort of places, and I always think of Portland as an island. You know, when I do the blog, I always describe it as the island.
You do.
Which isn't, you know, technically it is connected to the mainland. You know, we can just drive off and do whatever we please. The birding feel is very much island about it. It's
but it's also very handy for considering a patch.
Yeah.
Because a patch needs boundaries.
Yeah, for sure.
And if you've got that...
You've got a physical boundary to it, and you can really identify it with. Yeah. And I think that very much about Portland.
So I alluded to this earlier on, Martin. What is the point of a bird observatory in 2018? Have we not found everything we need to find? Have we not been monitoring chiff-chaff movements now for 50 years? We know when they come, when they go.
I guess probably you could argue that currently the situation is that, yes, we probably understand maybe as much as now as, you know, have we really moved on in, say, 10 or 20 years? I don't know that we really have. We do still keep doing exactly the same stuff here. I mean, I'm seeing, you know, in my birding career, the sort of the big change has been with the tracking of birds that's going on. And I you know, I wish that I could do that with my little passerines.
Yeah.
You know, I'm seeing all these amazing advances with sort of ospreys and these things where, you know,
you've got amazing
real-time sort of migration that you can just look at on your screen. And I am foreseeing that, you know, it will probably not happen during my career here, that before very long, sort of, we will be starting to do things like that at the bird observatories.
Right.
I think at the moment they are still a rather glorious sort of anachronism in some ways. But, you know, they are still in these crucial sort of migration watch point places, the Portlands, the Dungenesses, the Fair Isles, the Spurns, that really do, they still grip an awful lot of birders. Birders do love to see all this sort of stuff. And as birding has advanced, and, you know, if you look at it as an advance, I tend not to, as it's become gripped by sort of twitching and listing and whatever.
Oh,
you know, they are key locations for sort of rarities and things. You know, they are the sort of places that the listing community have to keep coming back to. And
but do you think when they do, they appreciate that they were originally set up to study
migration? Sadly, I don't think so. I think a lot of the listing guys, they're not really interested in that sort of thing. I suspect they probably would like to make out they are, but most of them are just sort of rabid sort of listers. You know, it's a wee bit dysfunctional thinking that sort of, you know, everybody in Britain has to go to North Ronaldsay to see the red-winged blackbird. I mean, is that really necessary? You know, especially in this day and age. I mean, you know, I used to twitch a lot before I came and worked here. I twitched an awful lot back in the 70s and 80s. And it was great, actually.
Yeah.
But I did think of it as a sort of era of great exploration. You know, you would go to see birds and you hadn't got a clue what you were going to go and see.
Yeah.
I had not a clue what some of the birds were going to look like. You know?
No, exactly.
Whereas now, social media being what it is, I always think, like, where's the excitement in this? You know exactly what it looks like before you've even set off, because a guy's already posted a back of the camera picture.
Well, it was also, I remember the first time I went to the Isle of Scilly in 1983, one of the first birds I saw was a green warbler.
Yeah.
I had no idea what a green warbler was going to look like.
No, you see,
I had no concept that I might one day be able to go where green warblers are supposed to be found. That was the other thing about twitching, wasn't it? They came to you. Birds you were never going to see.
That's right. I remember whether it was the year, I think it was the year after that, 84. I did see that. I saw the green warbler myself, and that was an exciting twitch. You know, I hadn't got a clue what a green warbler was going to look like in the flesh. But the next year, we had the savannah sparrow here. I remember, my mum used to sort of come and seek me out. She had a call. Mick would ring her up and say, "Wow, we've got this good bird, you know, can you find Martin and tell him?" That's how news worked in those days, you know. You didn't have a phone, you didn't have pagers. This was even before Birdline. And my mum came and got me and said, "Mick's rung up, there's a bird called a savannah sparrow at Portland." And I was utterly sort of, what the heck is that? Whether it was just a kind of momentary sort of lapse, but I couldn't even remember what part of the world it came from.
Yeah.
I mean, I may have seen it in an old Peterson North American guide, but it kind of hadn't occurred to me that it was a North American bird. So that was, things like that were so exciting.
It was.
Went out to, you know, I would rush out from Lobmore. I hadn't got a clue what the bird was going to look like. You know, I didn't even know where it came from. I found that really exciting. But I do not find twitching these days exciting. It almost seems like, people go and see it because everybody else sees it.
Yeah, you know, and they're far more. I mean, you can go and see, if you want to see a red-winged blackbird, it's a couple hundred quid on a plane.
It's actually cheaper.
And you can have a fantastic holiday for a couple
of weeks.
Cheaper to
go and see it in real life than it is.
We're going to break off because we're in the ringing hut and you've just been
Peter's just brought me a bird, which
so we
is
better
quite
get
amazing.
That out of the bag rather than keep it in there.
Early spring chiff chaff.
They're so small when you see them in the hand.
Yeah.
I'll never forget being down here one day years and years ago. Amazing the difference to how birds look in the hand to how they look in the field. And there was a bird in the nets. And I looked at it, it was brown, it was obviously a warbler, and I just couldn't think. I couldn't think, because I'd never seen it this close. I went, "Martin, what on earth is this?" And you just looked at it and went, "Oh, it's a rad's warbler."
Rad's warbler, I always remember, you were there that day, Charlie.
My God, so it is. And you just took one look and glance at it in the net, hanging there. So how many times have you rung a chiff chaff in your life,
it's several thousand.
And you still go through the same procedure?
We still do the same. Yeah, we do.
So you're taking the wing length
it's
measurements
quick,
and
then just weigh it,
Absolutely tiny, isn't it? They are miraculous when you think about what he's come from. So he will have come, he or she.
I mean, more than likely, this has been at least the Mediterranean, if not further. You know, I know they winter widely in Britain these days, but these ones that we're getting picked up at Portland now have probably spent the winter around the Mediterranean, most likely.
So as you've done with thousands of others, let it go in the garden.
I'll be back in a moment. I've just got to go.
The picture of the Chichapu ring had already gone out on social media. Mm. And I wanted to talk to you about social media because Portland adopted social media really well.
It did. Surprisingly quickly, considering that largely the folk here are dinosaurs, you know. The novelty of Twitter, you know, I latched onto quickly. I was quite an early adopter, if you know what I mean, from the Bird Observatory's point of view.
Yeah.
I'm not sure at the time I started on Twitter that any of the Bird Observatories actually were doing Twitter in any systematic way. But yeah, I kind of quite liked that idea that people were able to see instantaneously what we were doing. I don't know. I mean, maybe somewhere lost in there is a sort of, oh, you know, I'm going to show you how lucky I am. But that was not really the point of it. You know, the point of it was to sort of show folk that, you know, I can virtually tell them exactly what's happening with sort of South Coast bird migration.
In real time.
In real time. Yeah. And I was kind of really gripped by that idea. You know, and I think I was the subject of some derision for a while. You know, people like, Twitter, what are you doing?
I know,
you must
I was
be bonkers.
I like
but,
Twitter.
But first. I kind of understood it quickly. Mm. And I thought, wow, this is such a good way of, you know, getting over to ever such a wide community.
And
what I think we're doing here.
And am I right in saying that Portland was one of the first observatories to have such an active website?
I think so.
You updated
it
every single night.
Do you know, I still enjoy doing that. You might think, oh, that's a labour of love. We started that in, I think it was about 2000. Yeah. It must be something in 18 years.
It was very early on.
And I mean, it was difficult for me in the early days because I was not brought up with computers. Mm. You know, I was brought up in the era where you kind of flew to the moon using slide rules, you know? And I mean, I've always been kind of excited by that sort of stuff, that, you know, you can design sort of rockets to fly to the moon with, you don't actually need modern computing power. You know, those guys did it with slide rules.
Yeah,
I was brought up in an era where calculators were just coming in. So the internet was not a kind of natural thing to me at all. Computers were, something I was very kind of frightened of.
And you were having endless connection problems down here, I seem
to
remember.
I mean, obviously, you know, we still have connection issues, but not quite problems that we had then. I mean, when you think of the early days of it, you know, it was so hard to upload a photograph.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you could upload text just about. But, you know, I look back at the early days of the website and we had these teeny weeny little pictures and Quaft and I would sit watching them sort of churning over and, you know, you think, how did I do that? How did I have the patience? Yeah, that was not quite in real time. You know, Twitter, I could do it virtually in real time.
Yeah.
But on a daily basis, you know, I could communicate with, first of all, our members, our supporters, but also we a bit like the access to the OBS we were on about earlier. This is a sort of place where anybody can come. There's no charge. There's nothing. We're open. You know, it's an open all hours, no charge place. We always did that with a website. It was always anybody could look at it. There's no sort of pay firewall on it or anything like that.
That's right.
And I like that, you know.
Yeah.
Increasingly, you know, you go to sort of papers in academia, you know, I go to look at some paper about something or another and I find it's behind a blinking paywall. Mm. All that annoys me.
Mm.
You know, I'm sure that wasn't the idea of Berners-Lee when he dreamt up the internet. You know, it should be, everything should be there for everybody, and I still maintain that sort of ethos, and basically everything we do is there for anybody. You know, we've got copious amounts of data.
I was going to say exactly that, because everything's still archived.
Got a brilliant, brilliant data
fantastic.
Set, you know, and I mean, some of the other bird observatories, frankly, have got an even more amazing one that goes right back to the 30s, you know, Scotholm and places like that. But Portland's got a great data set, which goes back into the 50s, and all that, currently is being uploaded onto the BTO's bird track thing, which is, you know, it's been a bit of a labour of love involving volunteers, you know. I have actually had very little to do with it. You know, I have sort of coordinated our end of it, but it's mostly been done by sort of volunteers. So very shortly, everybody will have instant access to all of our data, which is, I think that, again, is magnificent. You know, they always have had access to it, but they've had to turn up and look through dusty old logs to extract what they want. But we don't charge for anything like that.
This is
a freebie to the world, you know, and it's nice in this day and age.
I think it is.
There is this sort of info out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, our data set is going to be a lovely one, you know. We will be able to sort of chart the sort of ups and downs of all sorts. And you know, the guys who do turn up and do their little bit of flogging round each day, you know, they're still chipping into that now, which is magnificent.
We've talked an awful lot about birds, but of course, Portland is also famous for other forms of biodiversity.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean,
and you are one of the great moth people in the UK.
Again, we were fairly early adopters of sort of moth traps. That actually predates me. That gets right back to the era of, well, even Frank Clafton, sort of Ian Robertson, Mick Rogers, they always operated moth traps. I personally really enjoy it. And so it's a thing that has taken off in my era. So from the sort of kind of perfunctory one moth trap that was always out, you know, I too tend to go overboard and I have eight on certain times. It looks interesting.
I know, sometimes from a distance, this place looks like it's lit
it's
up.
Kind of, yes, it does. You know, I've actually had people who've been on boats offshore at night and said, you're never going to believe what it looks like at night. It's so bright. But we're in a great place for that.
Yeah.
The same as we are for sort of migrant birds.
Yeah,
you know, we're in a fabulous place for tapping into sort of moth and butterfly immigration.
A remarkable moth list now. Oh,
the moth list
over 1,270.
Yeah, it's towards 1,300 moths. The PBO garden is quite an amazing place, and I think I've worked out that there can't be another single location as good as PBO is for birds. I'm sure our species list for this garden, I mean, it's basically a half-acre garden.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's pretty small, isn't it?
The species, I can't tell you what species this, because I've never been into
never kept it.
Lists, but I occasionally will work it out and think, wow, there isn't anywhere else in Britain that can get anywhere near this. Not one location. And the moths are like that as well. I mean, our moth list, the garden moth list is staggering. And there are actually one or two other single locations which have got higher moth lists,
right?
The, you know, odd places in southeast England, whatever, which even more favoured geographically. But we're pretty favoured geographically moth wise, and so our moth traps are they're very popular.
It was you that got me interested in moths.
I'd never looked
at moths, and I remember one night you sort of said, "Come on, we'll go and have a couple of beers and sit out," and that's what we did. We just sit out down towards West Cliffs, West Cliffs that way, East Cliffs it must have been, and we just had a couple of beers, and the moths would come in, and you'd wander over and see what was outside the thing.
It's as exciting as the birding.
Just fantastic.
You know, you just don't know what's going to come in.
And, it was a real eye-opener.
It was. And to say, that's carrying on now. And you just don't know what's going to appear. It's like, you know, the kid's jamboree bag. You open up the moth trap in the morning. And, you know, at times of good moth immigration, God, it can be exciting. The variety is magnificent. And I say, this is a thing which has taken off amongst birders. Moth trapping has become a really mainstream interest, which is great from the moth recording point of view. You know, a lot of the folk who've got into it have got into it through birding. The twitching of moths I do find quite bizarre. You know, I have to sort of keep things for several days in sort of plastic pots in my fridge because, you know, every Tom, Dick and Harry from various parts of Britain want to come and see the rarity. I just think, what? Is this real? You know, you're kind of driving from wherever, hundreds of miles in some cases, to see something which is in my fridge. Is that what nature study is all about?
Well, I suppose in the same way that we used to twitch birds in the 80s, you just felt you couldn't go over and see them. And I know quite a lot of these are very common over the just across the channel.
Yeah, sure,
but you still, you do have to take equipment over there. You'd have to set up. Wonderful to come down here and just
see them in plastic pots in my fridge.
Yeah, yeah.
That is a funny business. But whatever, you know, there's a lot of people sort of get enjoyment out of it. So,
and know, I remember there was a guy down here who was an expert on hoverflies, and he got me interested in. He didn't know he'd got me interested in hoverflies. It was only years later that I remembered that, and I thought hoverflies are fantastic little creatures. Really not appreciated by an awful lot of people.
It's amazing how much after all these years of being here, you know, this incredible list of discoveries every year just in this little half acre garden. You know, I'll get a new specialist in something or another sort of roll up on our doorstep, and he has a walk around the garden and comes up with something. We've had quite a lot of new for Dorsets and all sorts found entirely randomly by people like that. You know, it's a lovely, lovely spot.
You did a survey on shield bugs, didn't
you? We've done a lot of those sort of things over the years. Anybody looking at this from a distance might think, oh, you know, this is going to be repetitive, you know, half acre garden, 30 years, you must be bonkers. But the stuff that turns up new is quite amazing. It's so frequent.
You go a lot deeper than just new. I mean, on moths, you really are. I mean, I may have sounded like I was being flippant, but you really are a moth expert.
Well, you know, perhaps just on the moths of here, which, you know, does encompass quite a lot because we've got however many is 1,300 species. So, yeah, you do tend to get pretty good. And, yeah, I'm always getting people bring pots to me. So, oh, what's this? And whatever. But yeah, you do become an expert. But, you know, there are, certainly with moths, there are other guys who know an awful lot more than me. I mean, I'm not a specialist in it. It is a sideline to the birding, but it's a sideline which has kind of grown and grown.
If you were ever forced to choose, could you, between moths and birds?
I could easily do either of them. I really enjoy sort of summer mothing, you know, taking the moth trap out sort of in the summer, taking a generator out sitting around a moth trap.
It's a surprisingly sociable
thing. It is a surprisingly sociable thing, but this is me. I tend to do it on my own, actually. I mean, I enjoy that. I really do. I still take the generator out, and, you know, it does tend to be on my own, actually. I know that sounds a bit strange. You know, it could easily be a social thing.
I guess down here, you're constantly on, aren't you, during the day?
Yeah,
everyone comes to you. All the activities go through you. Yeah. The questions go through you.
It is great to have a little bit of me time. Yeah. And something like the moth trap, just taking a generator into the countryside with a moth trap and just sitting there on your own and mulling over the events of the day. Is quite kind of therapeutic.
We all need therapy at some point.
Because you know the next morning you're going to be harangued immediately.
There's going to be a lot of people coming
or another.
You've got a legendary patience, Martin.
You do need the patience of Job to do a job like this. You know, some of the questions you get, they are the sort of things that would send some people over the edge.
The gardens here didn't used to have all of this cover, did it?
No, it was just a bare garden. I mean, you know, in the early days of the OBS, there was nothing here. Right. The main part of the garden was actually not a part of the old lighthouse property. When Helen bought the lighthouse, she bought with it a sort of an adjacent field. So the main part of the Bird OBS garden was just purely a sort of grotty old bramble infested field which he bought off someone or other. I don't quite know who, but I'm not sure of the circumstances of that. But all the trees that you see here now are all planted up, you know, by the pioneers in the 60s. The ones who are still around now are aghast. I actually spend half the summer chopping them down because, you know, they've got so well established.
They are there,
that they actually need a lot of management to keep them in order.
You've sort of created almost like a mini woodland here.
The whole thing
while hedgerows have been lost everywhere else.
The whole thing is a lovely project, really. Yeah. You know, if you sort of look at it all, it's a brilliant project. You know, we've sort of created this superb habitat. And like you say, as everything else has been lost, all the sort of hedgerows lost and whatever, you know, we've established something which is really, really migrant friendly. It's an ace little sort of oasis for. So this time of year, it's stuff arriving in over the channel, but in the autumn, it's t'other way round. You know, it's birds just fueling up before they leave.
I always tend to fret about land being lost, and that one day I'll come down here and there'll be nothing but a town with this little garden. But I guess, I mean, this is a protected headland.
It is supposed to be, and I'm not foreseeing any great threat to that. I mean, South Portland is a sort of protected, development-free sort of area. And there is one or two people over the years have managed to get round it in small ways, but not in a profound sort of manner. You know, there hasn't been a housing estate sprung up anywhere where there wasn't one on South Portland. But, you know, there has been so many changes, particularly to the ordinary land use, that, you know, you do have to do a lot yourselves to keep it in order.
It's mainly recreational change, isn't it?
That change has been profound. And so a lot of the fields have gone over to horsey grass pastures, sort of horse folk. But, the amount of foot traffic on South Portland around the coastal footpath, for example, as leisure time has increased. Right, again, in the very earliest days of the pioneers coming here, there was, I think it was 25 pairs of puffins still bred at South Portland. And apparently they were dotted all the way along the East Cliffs, the low sort of cliffs, which are now, you know, they're just awash with people walking the Jurassic coastal path. Yeah, there is mountain bikers, there is rock climbers. Yeah, the poor old puffins, we're down to sort of one or two birds now. You know, they have probably got no future on Portland just because there isn't enough habitat. Yeah. But there has been a profound change in, you know, folks' leisure activity. I mean, the birding has changed so much. I mean, in that era, if you wanted to come birding at Portland, you came and spent a week here, you know, whereas now, you know, you come and basically, I put news of a yellow warbler out on my Twitter, and you drive from the Midlands, see the yellow warbler, and go home again. You know, there has been a...
Where did everybody park for that?
Where they shouldn't have parked, but it ended everywhere. Up as not too much of an issue. You know, it was late in the evening when it didn't cause too much of a problem. But, you know, yeah, if you sort of rack up on a clear way and there's a yellow warbler beside a clear way, chances are if you've driven the last 4 hours, you are going to park on that clear way, whether you're supposed to or not. And they did. But that was a very short stay,
wasn't it?
It was only a sort of an afternoon bird. Yeah, folk did not have the opportunity, certainly from further than 3 or 4 hours away, to have seen it. The bird wasn't found until the middle of the afternoon.
If we were going to envy you for your job, Martin, and I've always envied you for your job because I just think it's just incredible. Should we be envying you for the natural rhythms that you can get into? Should we be envying you for the study of migration? Or should we really be envying you for yellow warblers and water thrushes?
Yellow warblers and water thrushes are great.
Fantastic rarities.
It is ever so exciting that in your local patch, you know, you have got these... Yeah, hitherto undreamt of.
Yeah.
Nobody would have imagined in
years it was going to be a yellow warbler.
It's a brilliant local patch. It's fantastic. But I don't think folk, you know, the way people bird these days, I don't think they'd envy that too much, because it's become much more twitchy, much more list orientated birding, hasn't it, really? I suspect folk like that would not find it exciting enough. You know, one yellow warbler a year would not be exciting enough for them. You know, they need to...
There's a lot of
They need to get
stuff.
Their fix most weekends of something.
For you, then, is it still... It's still migration.
I think it's still the overall... It's the kind of excitement of migration.
We're talking about April the 4th, I think it is today, isn't it? So you're feeling the same way about spring as you have done every year.
Today's rubbish, but, you know, it could easily have been a really, really good fall. You know, you could have got up and it would have been jumping with phyllosks and blackcaps and the first red starts and pied flycatchers. Most of those things haven't come.
It's probably a good job it hadn't, because I wouldn't have got
you
to myself for
an hour and a half. So long just, you know, chewing the cud.
Yeah.
But that is so exciting. I think it's lovely. Yeah. I still feel quite privileged to be able to do that on a kind of, you know, year in, year out basis.
Yeah. You mentioned right at the beginning about horizons, and I said it was something I wanted to come back to. Because I've always felt that the very lucky few, very lucky, find their niche, their place, fall in love with it, and never want to leave it. Most people who do that have to leave it at some point. You're even luckier. You've not only found your niche, you found the place you love. You're here to stay. You've been here 30 years already. You've got no reason to go anywhere
I mean, perhaps, you know, I'm sure you could argue that I'm ambitionless. I haven't really got any ambition to do, you know. I don't want to sort of
But it isn't an ambition is always about yearning for something you haven't got.
Yeah.
Why would you need ambition when you've got what you want?
You know, there's plenty of folk who used to be bird observatory wardens, which have gone on to work in, you know, say the upper echelons of the RSPB or the BTO, and you know, become largely office based.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure they have a lot of influence. You know, it's lovely to think that they had a great grounding in. Sort of, you know, they spent those sort of years in really enjoying migration and getting a really good grounding in what it's all about, and then went on to become the decision makers and movers and groovers of, you know, birding, of conservation. That's great, you know, that's magnificent. I personally have no ambition to do that. I think I just get so much pleasure out of being on the ground, just wading through migrants, enjoying the spectacle of this, of opening the moth trap and finding the sort of the rarity or the tremendous number of things that have arrived overnight. I just get so excited by that still. I don't think I could be happy if I was not doing that on a daily basis. See, this has sounded a wee bit maybe selfish to say I'm not ambitious because I just want to be here all the time.
No, I hope, that doesn't sound as selfish.
You know, we have always, the successive observatory wardens here have always followed that ethos of trying to sort of, you know, educate others trying to be sort of helpful to fielding the sort of the questions from the sort of less informed visitors.
Yeah.
We've always done that. I do that all the time.
You've always done that.
I give an awful lot back.
You do.
In that department.
You do.
But, you know, in this day and age of social media, I think I give back an awful lot to, in a really wide, I hope people enjoy it. I know they do. You know, people look at the blog and say, it's just so good you do that every day. Do you know, it's the first blog I open up every morning and it gives me a lot of pleasure. And that pleases me no end. I hope I'm doing some good.
Oh, you are, yeah.
I don't think you need it.
No. I would never call you selfish in any way.
I really try to sort of follow, you know, Helen always kind of tried to get me into doing all this. And, you know, she was very much an educator in respect.
Yeah.
And I hope I'm giving back. I think I am.
I'm sure you are. I think I definitely am. I always end up these conversations, I'm kind of pushing people into retirement. Mm. You know, it's like, you know, you're like me, you're kind of late 50s.
Yeah.
I mean, you could keep doing this for many years, can you?
I can't really imagine giving up, because I would just imagine that if I did, I would still be out here every day anyway, doing exactly the same.
Still coming down every day. I don't know whether we said it on the recording or not, but you are very much synonymous with Portland.
Yeah, I guess it's so
Martin
long,
Cade.
Though. I don't really want it to be like that.
No.
I think I want it to be Portland Bird Observatory. You know, my social media, it's not about me.
No.
I never use I. I write in a very peculiar way, as people might have noticed. It's always we, our. I never do it. It's never me. It's not about me. It's about PBO. It's Portland Bird Observatory we're on about. You know, I kind of hope it's going to be here doing the same thing long, long after I'm gone.
I don't really like thinking about when you're not here, Martin. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I'm sure many people would love to thank you for everything you've done over the years, and I just happen to be the lucky one who can sit here and say thank you very much. Brilliant. It's been really great to see you again after a very long time.
It's been lovely having you back, Charlie.
Yeah, I must come down more often.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No problem.
Martin Cade talking with me in April 2018. The Bird Observatory really is a great place to visit and to feel a part of, and all the information you might need, including details of overnight room rates and a daily sightings log, can be found on the Portland website at portlandbirdobs.com. As we discussed, Martin is very active on Twitter, especially when there are good birds around, and he tweets at portlandbirdobs. You've been listening to a Sound Approach podcast, one of a growing collection of interviews and conversations with a focus on birds and conservation issues. If you'd like to learn more about The Sound Approach, the award-winning publisher that aspires to popularise birdsong and turn a world of bird watchers into bird listeners, please go to soundapproach.co.uk.